Welcome to another episode of the Evolved Idiots podcast. Today we have with us Jimmy Song. Thank you, sir, for being with me here this morning to chat and explore a lot of different aspects of the Bitcoin world.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to the discussion.
So, you know, we connected online, and but for those out there who don't know, you know, your background, just kind of give a little bit of that background. You know, how did you kind of get involved in this crypto game and end up where you are here today?
Yeah, so I've been a programmer for most of my life. I've been programming since I was like 9 years old. And I've been a professional programmer since I graduated college 23 years ago. And I've been working at various startups and worked for all kinds of different companies. And, you know, that's my background. I'm a coder by nature.
Okay.
2011, I read a story on Slashdot that said Bitcoin has reached dollar parity. I didn't even know what that could possibly mean because like it was such a foreign concept to me at the time. But I read about it and I became convinced almost immediately that this was something that I should look much deeper into. And so I did. I tried to buy some back then, back when it had reached dollar parity. It was literally about a dollar. And I couldn't figure out, or I did figure out a way to do it, but you had to use a money transmitter service called Dwolla. And they, after you set up an account with them and you can transfer some money over, then you could then transfer that money over to an exchange in Japan called Mt. Gox. And at that point, you can buy some Bitcoin using that. That's how far back it was. It was too annoying, so I decided not to do it. So one of the biggest regrets of my life. Everyone has their own Bitcoin regret stories. That's mine. But that's how I got started. And I did eventually buy some, and I started getting involved in the Bitcoin open source community. And there's a lot of different Bitcoin open source projects out there in 2013. And as a result of that, I ended up learning a lot more about the internals of Bitcoin and all of the stuff that goes into it. And, you know, I became, I guess, something of a technical explainer person in 2017 as a, you know, the block size wars heated up and people needed somebody that could talk about it in an intelligible manner to non-technical people. And that's something that I've always had the ability to do. And that eventually led me to write a book, Programming Bitcoin. And that was more a way born out of frustration from not having really good resources to learn Bitcoin stuff from a programmer's perspective. Mm-hmm. And that did well. I started getting speaking engagements at different conferences, and I started a newsletter. I did a bunch of other things, but eventually that's where I've now written 3 books, and I've done a lot of podcasts like this one. I have my own podcast. I've got a newsletter. So yeah, I've become sort of like a social media influencer, is I guess what the kids call it these days, but something like that.
Well, it's interesting, you know. One of the reasons why I've listened to quite a few of your shows, and one of the things I like about it is, and we'll get into this a little more later, but I have a philosophy of I'm very skeptical of things that are just have no real value, and I think you seem to have this same sort of ideology, which to me. So I kind of steer away from a lot of the things that are just don't seem to have a functional application in real life. And it's one of the things that I think you do pretty well is really explain how these technologies can really functionally change, you know, different aspects in real life for everyday people, which I think is important for people to understand it, because crypto and blockchain is very confusing. Like I think decently intelligent person, but I'm certainly not a coder or anything. And, you know, it's, you know, I've honestly been really paying attention and haven't had anything to put, you know, haven't had anything invested until the last year. And so I'm still really, really early in my knowledge. But very similarly, I remember people talking about this years and years ago. And of course, I kick myself now, too, for not doing it, not as early as you, but still having got in at $1,000 would have been a great return at this point. So.
Or even $10,000.
Yeah, 100%.
$30,000. They're all great returns. Yeah. And that's something that a lot of people kind of have trouble with is understanding Bitcoin, because like just understanding Bitcoin requires you to understand money. And the thing, fact of the matter is, very few people understand what money actually is. They use it, they earn it, they buy things with it, they store value in it, and all kinds of other stuff. But they don't actually know what it is, what it represents, how it works, especially the current monetary system. And it takes a lot of time to really understand how it works. They've purposefully kind of made it difficult to understand to get away with a lot of the money printing that they currently do. So we know, for example, that the money supply has increased something like 25% in the last year. And very few people understand what that actually means or what, you know, how that affects them. But you could see it everywhere in the economy today, right? Like you have what are called supply chain disruptions, which are not really supply chain disruptions. They're prices sort of resetting higher, and people are always reluctant to pay more money for what they used to get for less money. So that's happening all throughout the supply chain. And of course, that's going to cause disruption. There's also, you know, like prices that are just increasing all over the place. I went to Costco yesterday. And I think this is the first time ever that I spent over $1,000 without just buying groceries, which was... Now, I have a big family, right? I have six kids. So it's a big family, and I do buy a lot of food and things like that. But I don't think I've ever spent more than $600 at Costco, like ever, right? And this, you know, like, and $600 was at the height of, you know, like having to buy like 3 packs of diapers every time I went and all kinds of things like that. But I spent over $1,000, right? And that's because food prices are going up, especially the price of meat, which I bought a lot of yesterday. And that's something that a lot of people just don't really understand, largely because they've never been taught it. They've never really questioned it. They just sort of are told to be compliant. And that's unfortunately sort of the mentality that we're... forced into from a very young age, right? Like the 12 years in school that you're, you know, forced to go to by the state are almost entirely based on your level of compliance with the teacher and not about your actual learning of anything. It's spitting back whatever the teacher says, or, you know, you end up, you know, playing to the test or whatever, but it's the entire system set up so that you won't learn very much about the monetary system that we live under. And that's why, you know, learning about Bitcoin is very tough. And I do want to just mention that if you say crypto or blockchain, I almost immediately know, okay, you haven't studied this stuff enough. Because
I give myself away.
Yeah,
my disclaimer, my disclaimer's in the show title. So
there you go.
Yeah. So you mentioned something that was very interesting, which I have been trying to read about, because I formerly in my form many, many lifetimes ago now, I do have a background in education in finance, but it's been years since I've actually worked in it. So I might as well almost not have it. You know what I mean? But one of the things that I have revisited since like trying to educate myself on this is just going back and revisiting, there's been a lot of things since I was in school anyway. The things I was taught, you mentioned something else that was very interesting to me, is about the way you adapt what the teacher wants instead of like truly learning something, maybe, because I can remember a project I was given in college, actually, where we were supposed to manage these portfolios and crunch these numbers and use these equations. And I remember watching the markets and going and just running my portfolio off of the news, off of the news titles, off of the news, what was happening in the news with the companies. And I ended up doing very well, but he didn't like my explanation on as to how I had attained my success on it, because I didn't use anything he had taught me, basically. And so, you know, I totally get that point. But one of the things I've really, you know, come full circle is the realization of how far detached we are from our money system. You talked about the monetary system and the layers we are removed from actual value, from the actual thing of value. It's not gold anymore, but I guess for years it used to be gold. There were still so many layers away from it. We're all trading and have been trading for decades on, you know, faith and goodwill and the belief that this thing we have is going to transact for us and continue to hold value without really knowing whether or not it is. And now we're no longer even on the gold standard. We're just totally, you know, this fiat money just seems to totally be, I don't know what the right word is. There seems to be no backing for it. It's totally being, you know, kind of manipulated. And it's even more concerning when you talked about, you know, prices rising, because I feel like when I hear the talking heads on TV, running on about economics and policy, monetary policy, they seem to all be these what I think, if I understand things right, this Keynesian like ideology where as long as we keep the GDP up and everybody in numbers keep going up, it doesn't matter how much debt we're in. We'll just continue to just make more money and it won't matter. The debt doesn't matter anymore. And I don't know, that's just kind of counterintuitive. And it's one of the things that I like sort of about the Bitcoin, because it is a fixed amount.
Yeah, the entire fiat monetary system is a giant scam. That's the thing that a lot of people don't really understand, is that new money is always sort of like printed into existence in the form of loans. So to just like break it down to the very basic level for your listeners, whenever the government has a deficit, and this has happened, I think, pretty much every year since the creation of the Federal Reserve, or even before that, right? I think the last president to really balance the budget was like Andrew Jackson. So pretty much every president and every Congress has deficit spend, which means that there's a gap. You get, say, $5 trillion in revenue, and you're spending $7 trillion. What do you do with how do you get that extra $2 trillion to close that budget gap? Well, this is where the Treasury technically issues treasuries, right? Like, these are U.S. government bonds that are issued to the public, and they sell them so that they could have the money to pay for the extra $2 trillion in the budget that they didn't get from tax revenue. Okay, but there's not $2 trillion worth of money that's willing to go and buy treasuries, especially when they're paying like less than 1%. So where does it come from? Well, there are some public players that will buy some. There are even foreign central banks that will buy some, though that hasn't been happening lately because we're in sort of an economic slowdown. So what ends up happening is that the Federal Reserve steps in, and they are called the lender of last resort for that reason. They will buy up whatever the Treasury puts out. And you might be asking, okay, well, where does the Federal Reserve get this money? Out of nothing.
Yeah.
they create the money out of nothing, and they say, well, it'll balance out when they pay it back. So it's a giant scam, right? Like, you know, they're lending out credit that doesn't exist. And that's how new money comes into existence. And this isn't just at the federal government level. It's at every level, okay? State governments do something very similar. They issue bonds, and oftentimes they're bought by, you know, commercial banks who then in turn get a loan from the Federal Reserve, and they arbitrage that. So it ultimately comes from the Fed. There's also like residential loans, like, you know, your 30-year mortgage of $500,000 at 3%. It's not coming from anyone's savings. It's printed into existence. This is how new money gets created. And it's all a scam because that money doesn't exist. It's just created on a ledger as a liability and an asset, right? That's basically it. It's a liability for you, the borrower, and it's an asset for the bank or whatever. It's created out of literally nothing. So all that is to say that the entire system is premised on debt, on this idea that you can just issue more debt whenever you want to get out of any financial pickle that you might be in. And that's how we've been operating for a very long time. And this works fine until it doesn't. And it doesn't when people start anticipating the inflation. And when people start anticipating the inflation, then the government needs to print even more to get, you know, even because their budget simply isn't going to be enough. Everything's just going to cost more when it comes time to actually spend it. So they have to print even more. And this is what you would call hyperinflation. And something pretty much almost every fiat currency that has ever come into existence has eventually ended up in the grave of hyperinflation. The ones that are going through it right now are, you know, something like the Venezuelan Bolivar. Currencies in Turkey, Lebanon, and Nigeria are very quickly inflating as well. And many more throughout the world as this monetary expansion continues. But this is what's actually happening is, a lot of value ultimately is being stolen away through this newly printed money. And that this is something that very few people understand. Very few people really like even have the necessary economic outlook to be able to understand. Instead, they think like Keynesians and think that breaking a window is adding economic value somehow. So it's kind of a sad situation, but thankfully, like, reality has a way of sort of slapping people in the face and forcing them to learn a little bit more than they otherwise would.
So is part of the reason that they've been able to get away with this policy, with this philosophy, because they removed themselves from the gold standard? So they were no longer, quote unquote, devaluing the actual thing it was based on. They just said, we're not going to base it on anything except what our belief is, basically.
Well, according to the U.S. Constitution, the U.S. dollar still has to be backed by gold
the reserves.
But the way the legal fiction is still that we are kind of backed by the gold standard in the sense that in 1971, when Nixon cut the ties to gold, he said it was temporary, that, you know, at some point you'd be able to redeem it again. That temporary has lasted 50 years and we're not going to go back to it anytime soon, because at the time that they did it, it was $35 per ounce of gold. Right now it's like 1900 or something like that. It's significantly more. So, right. There's no way that they have that much gold to be able to, you know, allow it to be convertible again. So really, dollars are not backed by anything in practical reality. But the legal fiction, I think, still exists that it's backed by gold or something like that. But it's a completely meaningless sort of like legal fiction, because it practically doesn't mean anything.
One of the things that has surprised me is, you know, going back and really looking at how things evolved was how they have allowed, and way back many years ago when they first allowed banks to start, what is it called, where they, I can't think of the term that they use at the moment, but it's basically where they loan out more money than they have in reserve.
Mm-hmm. Reserve lending.
Fractional reserve. Thank you, sir. Yes, that's it. Yeah, it amazes to me that that we're allowed to do this, that this is legal in any way at all, because like you should have to be able to, you know, call in your money if you're one of those people that have money with that bank. And I don't know. It seems very, this is like what something a scam artist in the streets would do.
Yeah. I mean, it's completely fraudulent. Fractional reserve lending has been from the beginning a form of fraud. The thing is though, that it's very hard to catch people doing it unless you have a run on the bank. Right. And that's, you know, where the word bankruptcy comes from. It's a bank that didn't have enough to fill all of their depositors. So legally, what you're doing when you're depositing money at the bank is you're technically kind of lending them your money. And
sure.
And whenever, if they can't pay it back, then you're kind of on the hook. Although there's like FDIC insurance, so you know, the government ends up being on the hook and they'll make you whole at least up to a certain amount and so on. But that's how it works legally. It's again, like one of those weird fictions that exist. But yeah, fractional reserve lending is highly immoral. It is fraud and it's, you know, still practiced to this day. And it started, you know, back when people were using gold as money. And people didn't want to, you know, have to take care of the gold and on their own, because if you get it stolen away from you, it really sucks. So instead, they would keep it with a security professional. And usually these were goldsmiths that knew how to secure gold very well. The thing that the goldsmiths realized is, oh, you know what? I could lend out some of this and make a profit on it. And then they started incentivizing people to store gold with them by paying out some of that interest and sharing it. But it turned out that, you know, they could lend out more gold than there was in the vault by issuing paper certificates that were the equivalent. And this is where, you know, fractional reserve lending really took off. They could make enormous profits. So if you're fractional reserve lending at like 10% or something like that, you, that means you lend out 10 times the amount that's actually in the vault. And say you're charging like 5% interest and you're paying out your the people that deposited at 3%, you might think, okay, they're making the 2% spread. No, because they're lending out 10 times as much. Right. So if you have $1 million, you have to pay out $30,000 in interest, but you're lending out $10 million. So that ends up being $500,000 that you're getting in interest payments for those loans. So $500,000 minus $30,000 is like $470,000. This is how banks make money. This is why investment banking and all this stuff is so incredibly profitable. And you know, that's essentially how, you know, things work, because there was this economic incentive to fractionally reserve lend, that only works up until, you know, there's a run on the bank or, you know, some of your lenders default or something like that. And you don't have enough money to cover all of the depositors, in which case you are, like, as I said, bankrupt, right? Like, the word has the word bank in it for a reason, because this happened to so many banks. But ultimately what ends up happening, is that, you know, all of these banks end up screwing over a lot of people, and because they're often highly connected in the community and they've, caused a lot of economic development, but that all collapsed when the bank does, governments have stepped in traditionally to sort of like bail them out and so on. And that's why it has a tendency to be legal. Just to let you know, like, even gold depositories now, much like the goldsmiths of yesteryear, do the same thing, except they lend out bars of gold that don't exist. And this is what you would call paper gold. This is why, to a large degree, like, gold price is kind of manipulated, because there are only like 7 or 8 really big gold vaults in the world. There's like one in London and one in Hong Kong and one in New York and stuff like that. And those fractionally reserve lend. So you might have 100 tons of gold in your vault, but you lend out like 200 tons worth of gold. And that ends up, like suppressing the price, because they just create more paper gold whenever everything gets inconvenient. And people don't want to transport gold anyway. So It's unlikely that you're going to get necessarily like big runs on these gold vaults, and that's how that sort of scam stays alive. But fiat money is even worse because there's nothing backing it, and they just print more of it whenever they need it. And that's what the Fed has been doing for, especially since 1971. Like it's expanded the monetary supply by a significant amount. M2 money supply, which is one measure of all the money that US dollars that exist, in 1959 was $289 billion. It is currently over 20 trillion. So in 62 years, we have expanded the monetary supply by a significant percent. If you annualize all of that, it ends up being something like 7% a year. And that's the classical definition of inflation, which is the amount of money that is being expanded. And it's been at 7% for a long time, which is very different than the 2 or 3% that the CPI tells you, which is what like government Keynesian economists have used to sort of like manipulate the public into thinking that, you know, things aren't so bad, basically. But 7% has been the norm for 62 years now.
Is there any particular reason so many people are in love with Keynesian economics, other than the fact that it lets you like do what you want without being responsible for it?
Yeah, that would be the exact reason. Yeah, like that. the people in power want to justify what they're doing, and Keynesian economics sort of gives them the moral justification to do it. And any other in any rational sort of like economic framework, you would clearly know this is fraud, this is theft, this is horribly immoral. But under Keynesianism, it's all justified because, you know, you can treat people like homo economicus, and they all will behave the same way given the same set of circumstances and so on, and therefore it is okay for them to do it because you can create value by breaking windows, right? Like that's sort of like the really odd and completely irrational and stupid, tenets of Keynesian economics. And it gives the government justification. And I call sort of like Keynesian economists largely like the new false prophets, right? Like they tell the government what they want to hear. And it gives them justification for doing whatever it is that they want to do. And it's always the people that are in support of government that are always talking about this all the time. So
it's very interesting because if I understand my history about Keynes himself, like he was kind of born into money and he didn't necessarily build anything. He just kind of lived a real lavish life, like nice life, and didn't really work very hard. So his philosophy may have not been derived from the most character building of journeys.
No. And in fact, if you read Safdie's book, you find out that he was also a pedophile. Like the guy is like, he's not what you would call somebody that had like very practical experience. And if you read any of his writing, it's like, it has no sort of like rational or logical basis. It sort of like brings up like animal spirits as if they're like perfectly clear to the reader. And it's like, he just kind of brings it out of nowhere, right? Like there's a lot of stuff like that. It's almost purposefully obfuscating. And the idea this again goes to like the whole idea of false prophets, right? It's a doctrine that is very open to interpretation, and it justifies almost anything and everything. So, the people that tend to think that Keynes was right are almost invariably people that want the government to have more power, or are people in power, or are benefiting from the state in some way. And it's no coincidence that almost every government economist is a Keynesian. They justify what the government is already doing, which is ultimately really just fraudulent and immoral and a cesspool of theft and so on. But that's how they kind of justify everything. And it's, if you look at it from a rational perspective, there's no contest. Keynesian economics is just utterly void of any logic or reason or any justification for it being true in any way, shape, or form. Whereas something like Austrian economics is a lot easier to understand,
right,
a lot more accurate, and a lot better at making predictions. And it's just a much better framework.
Yeah. You know, when I think back about where we're at now and how we're so centralized with our power and the control over the monetary system and everything, and I almost think, you know, looking back on it, especially when you were mentioned talking about carrying around gold and people that being inconvenient, it almost feels like through the evolution of humanity and the formation of society, it was inevitable that we had to centralize in order to be able to fully form our society. And up until now, we really haven't maybe had the right tangible thing to be able to allow us as a society to remain intact, but yet decentralize that power and that control until really Bitcoin was created. Do you think that this is obviously you believe in Bitcoin, but can you elaborate on kind of that thought about how, you know, this is, you know, at least that's my perspective, is that, you know, we kind of needed to be centralized and we really haven't had a way to break away from that until now because of the development of technology.
Well, so centralization does give you some levels of efficiency because you can scale a lot faster when you're centralized, right? Like, and this is something that's evident, especially monetary transfer. Carrying gold around and transferring it is very inconvenient, especially when it comes to large amounts. And sunken treasure ships of yesteryear will testify to this all the time. You couldn't go trade in India unless you brought some gold or silver, right? Like that's yeah. Why you had to bring it, because otherwise you couldn't trade. The whole trip would be non-successful. And so they had to build up all kinds of like insurance and things like that. And, these pirates were always sort of like, weird incentives that were there as a result of having to transfer it. But once you had centralization, what you could do was issue paper certificates. So that way you would have credit at some bank, right? Like you would have deposits at some bank, and they could have branch offices all over the world. So instead of, like carrying gold around, you can just go to India and they have a branch office in India, and if you need money, they'll let you withdraw from your account so you could trade locally and so on. It made it a lot more convenient and a lot more safe in many ways because you had this ability to transfer value very quickly over space. Similarly for centralization and especially like sort of countries and things like that, if you have the same set of rules over a large region, that tends to be very nice for everybody, because then you don't have to worry about the particular jurisdiction that you're in to see whether you're not you're allowed to do something or not. And it gives sort of like a lot more certainty going forward. And that's that can be a boon as well. The thing about money is that it there is a network effect, and I think this is what you're alluding to. When you're centralized, it's a lot easier to scale, and it does allow for this network effect to kind of work a lot faster and allow for sort of more commerce and faster trade and so on. Now, you could still do it under a gold standard, and we did that from something like 1870 to 1910 when the world was essentially on the gold standard. Every currency was convertible to gold. So like to do foreign exchange was very easy. You just multiply and divide and that's it. And you go from one currency to the other, and there wasn't really slippage because they were equivalent in terms of gold and so on. You could do it in a decentralized way. It's just that governments found it a lot more convenient to completely centralize by like going on a fiat standard. And this is what this was because largely because of war. World War I and World War II both spent money that they didn't have, right? All the countries involved in both world wars essentially, you know, like just printed more money to buy the weapons that they or needed, or you know, supply more troops or something like that. And really, it only ended when there were so few people left that they couldn't defend, you know, the Axis couldn't defend anymore. And that's, you know, like it came down to like they lost everything, and then they didn't even have people left to be able to defend. That's ultimately what it came down to before, you know, the fiat money was exhausted. And really, it wasn't even fiat money. It was just the lack of people. So all that it shows sort of like the reason why governments like fiat money. It's because they can steal from their citizens. And they already kind of do that through taxes. That's what we call, but you know, like generally most people, most societies are very resistant to explicit taxation. You know, that's what ultimately led to the US declaring independence from Britain, right? Like, you know, there was taxation without representation and all that stuff. And almost every revolution around the world is related in some way, shape, or form to taxation or capturing a value by the government. So what inflation allows you know, governments to do is to tax implicitly. Too many explicit taxes will almost always cause instability, but doing it through inflation, as World War One and Two showed, like nobody figures it out. Right? Like it's not obvious to them that they are being taxed and that their goods are being taken, or their time and value are being taken away from them. And ultimately, that's what's led to the consolidation that we have now. Of course, now we have Bitcoin, and that changes the equation quite a lot, because now you can opt out of the system, opt out of this system of theft, and make it so that the government can't just steal things away from you by inflating the currency. And that's a real different thing than we've ever really had.
Yeah. How concerned should we be about this spike in inflation we're having right now, do you think?
Well, I mean, depends on what your concerns are, right? Like, like prices are going up for sure. Yeah. M2 money supply has already expanded by a significant amount in the past year, something like 25% in the past 12 months, something like that. There's also a lot of, you know, like lots of goods and services that are, you know, not available, and that happens during inflation because prices are being reset. It's a lot of unions going on strike and things because, of course, they're not getting paid enough because their costs are going up and they're not getting paid enough. So this, like, if you read about the Weimar Republic, strikes happen like every single day, right? Like, because they were like, well, we're not getting paid enough and you need to pay us more. And that, like, strikes are really about money. And when the money is being manipulated, it's no wonder that becomes like a contentious thing. And yeah, basically you have disruption all over the economy. So in that sense, it kind of sucks. But, you know, we're not even at the bad part yet.
No.
Like, beef prices may have doubled in like the past 3 years or something, but you know, that's not nearly as bad as something like real estate, which has like gone crazy, right? Or stocks, which have also gone crazy. And there's just not like your wealth is being taken away, and there's not much you can do about it. So should you be concerned? Yes. But if you're a Bitcoin holder, at least you have a hedge.
That's true. So we've talked a little bit about the monetary policy and the history and those things. And the thing that makes Bitcoin to me very different that we've already touched on is the fact that it is a fixed quantity. But for people who don't maybe understand like why that's important to have a fixed quantity, Can you kind of just maybe explain that in a little more detail as to why that is an important feature of Bitcoin that we do not currently have with fiat money?
Yeah, so fiat money, the central controller can print more of it whenever they want. This is why it's expanded by 25% in the last year. And that means that your dollar isn't worth as much as it used to be. And that's that in a hyperinflation scenario, your dollar goes to zero very, very quickly. And that sucks because that's money that you earn through your labor or, you know, like trading goods that you might have had and so on. So if it's rapidly depreciating, then you're not going to want to hold it. And it sucks very much because there's no easy way to like plan for the future because money is usually how people save. But now people are forced to use like, you know, real estate or stocks or something like that. It's just it's horrible. Yeah. The thing about Bitcoin that's very different than even gold is that it has what's called an absolute scarcity. There will never be more than 21 million Bitcoins. Even gold has, has historically been fairly small in its inflation or its rate of expansion. So any given year, gold miners will dig up from the ground about 2% of the supply of gold that already exists in the world. Mm-hmm. So this is what you would call an inflation rate of 2% or a stock to flow ratio of 50. So the current stock of the item versus the newly produced is the ratio is 50, or it's if you invert it, it's 2% of the total. And the remarkable thing about gold is that it's been that way for about 5,000 years, is that it's expanded at a 2% rate on average for 5,000 years. And, you know, no technology so far has been able to create that much more gold. Although if such a technology comes along, then, you know, like all bets are off. It would be demonetized very quickly. This is how currency, a lot of decentralized currencies have died. So salt used to be used as money, but it's no longer because people figured out how to make giant quantities of it. Glass beads used to be used as money. Rye stones used to be used as money. Wampums used to be used as money. All of those are no longer money because people figured out ways to create large quantities of it very, very quickly. So the thing that's very different about Bitcoin is that it's got an absolute cap, and that's because it is guided by computer code and no one can change it. So in the first 4 years of Bitcoin, exactly half of the 21 million was created through this process called mining. So 10.5 million. And then over the next 4 years, it was exactly half of the remaining, or 5.25 million. And then over the 4 years after that, it was half of the remaining of that, which is 2.6125 million, and so on until it asymptotically goes towards 21 million. Doesn't quite get there, but you can see how essentially you are under 21 million for all of eternity, and that gives you certainty on the monetary supply, and that therefore it makes it a lot easier to be certain that, like 20 years from now, if you own one Bitcoin, you still have 21 millionth of all the Bitcoin that exists, as you would 50 years from now or 1 year from now. And that's a real certainty that's very useful. Whereas with, you know, the US dollar, who knows, if you have $60,000 in US dollars, you have some fraction now, but it's going to be an even smaller fraction 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now.
When it comes to the altcoins, I'm almost really starting to view a lot of the altcoins as equal to a fiat in a way, because I've tried very much to stick. So I haven't put a lot in, but and I don't have many. But, you know, I've tried to stick to ones that I feel like have a real life application somehow. in reality. And it's not just like, you know, I didn't jump in on Doge. Right now I'm being told Shiba Inu is the way to go, that people are going to make a ton of money. I don't know. I tend to stay away from those things because to me, the altcoins, like I tried to really follow the market closely, you know, several months ago. And it really was like, I came to the conclusion that if you wanted to trade on the altcoins and really make money, you had to watch the markets every day and for a decent a part of the day to really like, to really make a good money and not lose money on that. So like I stay away from that because I don't have the time for it. I guess my question about the alts would be, how do you see the ones that have a practical application versus the quote unquote meme coins, which, you know, obviously to me are very much like a fiat because it's just a belief in it. Is Ethereum kind of like the one that stands out that might be the exception, or is it even considered an altcoin really?
It is an altcoin and they're all scams. And your instinct is absolutely right. They are very much like fiat. We have a saying in Bitcoin that you can be your own bank, right? And instead of leaving it with a central controller, you have control of it. With altcoins, you can be your own central bank. That's basically what they are, right? Like they're all fiat currencies, like including Ethereum. Ethereum is actually one of the worst ones in terms of they had a pre-mine of something like 70% of the supply. So it went all to insiders and people that got in early and so on. And they're the ones that pumped the hell out of it. And they're the ones that continue to give it a new marketing spin, right? The latest is DeFi and NFTs or whatever. But yeah, it's all centrally controlled. So it really doesn't have anything that's useful. If it's centrally controlled, it's going to be like 30 times more efficient if you use a centralized database instead of this cumbersome thing called the blockchain. But if they did that, then they get, you know, sued by the SEC. So the only reason why they call it an altcoin or a token or something like that is to get around regulatory hurdles. And, you know, they keep this sort of like weird fiction that we're decentralized so that they don't get regulated by the SEC or somebody else. I think Gensler has had enough of it. He's already come out and said, you know, other than Bitcoin, I don't see anything out there that isn't a security. So, he's probably going to try to at least regulate a lot of it. He's probably going to fine a bunch of these people. You know, who knows, based on like FinCEN rules and stuff like that, some of these people might go to jail. But ultimately, like none of these things have any utility, any value, any reason to exist. The question that you should always ask as an investor is, why do you need a token? Because if it were actually useful, you could just build it using Bitcoin and it would be fine. You don't need your own token, right? Like it doesn't make any sense. You already have money. Why do you need another token? For what purpose? It just makes the monetary network way more fragmented. And we know that monetary networks converge. So it doesn't make any sense. So the way I look at it is these are all scams to get people to speculate and gamble. People like speculating, people like gambling. And you know, a lot of people feel like they missed out on Bitcoin, so they're looking for something else to get them those gains. They don't really recognize like a lot of what's happening. All that is to say that, I don't believe this is why I said, like, when you say the word crypto, I immediately know that you're kind of new, because if you actually study this stuff, you would recognize, okay, Bitcoin is actually decentralized and interesting and has utility. All this other crap has no utility. It's people playing with illegal securities. It's like a bunch of penny stocks that are not regulated whatsoever. And as a result, you get lots of pumps, lots of dumps, lots of fraudulent activity, lots of weirdness that's happening all the time, where, you know, some random coin gets pumped up like 30x in like a couple of days, because of course there are insiders that are doing something and they're pumping it using Twitter bots and Reddit bots and, you know, like different YouTube shows and things like that. It's, yeah, just stay away. I highly recommend that you just stay away. Keep your money in Bitcoin. And over a 5-year period, like just look at what coins were popular 5 years ago, and like the top 10 in CoinMarketCap 5 years ago, and check them against today and how they've done against Bitcoin. And you'll see that most of them have gone down 80%, often more than 95% against Bitcoin.
Yeah, when I first started to try and get into this, I listened to all these different podcasts, and there's so many of these guys that I now refer to them as hype people, and they just hype everything all the time. Like, I've heard for the last year that Bitcoin was going to hit $360,000 this year before the end of the year so many times, and they're still kind of screaming, you know, even in this fourth quarter, for some really insane, you know, projections. And it just kind of becomes very obvious that a lot of these coins, like, I listened to one out of curiosity the other day. I hadn't listened in months and months and months. And the altcoins that were popular the last time I listened to that show, it was all different new altcoins. It's like, not even the old ones are done and we're off to these new ones. And it really does seem like it's just like whoever's doing the best marketing at the time online and has the most people talking about their stuff online are the ones that are moving, you know, upward in the markets. You know, you also touched on regulation. How do you, so it sounds like you might be in favor of regulation. I don't want to speak for you though, but like, how do you sort of see that like playing out, the whole regulation thing? Because to me, like, that is the one key thing that sort of can't happen to Bitcoin in particular. Like, I totally could see this happening for many of the reasons you stated about the altcoins. But to me, like, government coming in and taking control of regulating Bitcoin itself is a little worrisome with all the other consolidations of power we've recently seen. You know, it's even maybe more alerting.
Yeah, so they could try. And certainly places like China have tried and been kind of unsuccessful because it's actually decentralized. But, you know, like a lot of other altcoins, it's not like that. Once they get regulated, it means like death, basically. So I'm kind of a mixed mind about this. On the one hand, I'm a libertarian. I don't like regulation. I don't like the government sort of telling you know, people what to do and like forcing things to be done a certain way or whatever. But at the same time, like, you know, a lot of these altcoins exist only to skirt regulation, right? Like they're right. Basically issuing an illegal security without any public information being disclosed, without any investor protections and things like that. And I think if they are going to regulate at all, it should be a level playing field, and it's not. If you're a public company, you have all sorts of regulatory requirements, like filing a 10K and this and that. And if you miss any of those, you go ahead, put on the pink sheet, and you know, you get SEC fines and things like that. None of these altcoins get any of that, and that's why they operate in that space, is because they're able to skirt these laws. There have been schemes like that for a long time. And the SEC was created to make sure that these schemes didn't sort of proliferate. But they continue proliferating because they pretend that they're decentralized, when in fact they're highly centralized and benefit a few people at the expense of the many, which is more or less what most fraud is. Yeah, I would say that, you know, I have mixed feelings on, but regardless of what happens, I think Bitcoin survives okay, because Bitcoin is Bitcoin. It's actually decentralized. You know, other stuff I can't speak to, but I suspect that they're going to do much worse because they're all centralized.
Do we need one altcoin to like survive to be able to be? Because Bitcoin, if I understand this correctly, is more labor intensive or energy consumption or something to those effects. It takes longer to process because it is dealing on the blockchain, I think, if I understand that correctly. And it would be more efficient to have a secondary for smaller currency to do smaller transactions on, for like buying coffee. Like if we ever really want to get to the point where we're swiping out our Bitcoin card and just paying for everything on with Bitcoin, do we need something that would be actually an intermediary that would process faster and more efficiently than Bitcoin for those transactions?
And we certainly could, but you don't need an altcoin. You can do it using something on layer two called Lightning Network, and that is very fast. It's instant settlement, more or less, or the speed of email getting there, something to that effect. So for all practical purposes, that's way better than any altcoin is going to be, because even the fastest ones have like 10 second block times. That's still longer than what Lightning will take and so on. But I mean, like there's no reason why, a payment network like Visa or MasterCard can't settle in Bitcoin, right? Like that's another sort of possible layer too. They already do like 34 different currencies around the world. So adding another one wouldn't be very hard at all. Now it would be centralized and you'd lose a lot of privacy and so on, but it's something that that they can do. And if it's convenient enough for people and they incentivize people enough, that's something that many people might like, just be willing to do. So I don't see a need for altcoins for that reason. And as far as sort of like energy usage goes, most people that talk about the about Bitcoin's energy usage really have no idea how the energy market works. It's not one giant world market. I can't go and get hydroelectric power from Shenzhen or something like that, right? Like that's not how it works. There's a local market, and within the local market, there's competition, and that's what determines the price for my utilities or whatever. But there's tons of energy that's either stranded or produced excessively. Like hydroelectric dams are big for that reason. Like, you can produce a lot of energy, but a lot of that energy just doesn't go into use. Oftentimes it's wasted. So that's the energy that's the cheapest in the world. And that's the energy that Bitcoin miners take. So this notion that Bitcoin is this huge energy waster is completely untrue. It's actually making use of energy that would have been wasted anyway.
Yeah, most of the people I've heard bring that up are not necessarily fans of Bitcoin or the technology advancement anyway. They tend to be more traditional thinking when it comes to that. You mentioned DeFi earlier, which is super hot. Everybody's talking about this. So I'll admittedly will say that I don't really understand what it means. It's, I assume, decentralized finance. So you can finance yourself decentralized. Is it only available on through ETH? Is that true?
DeFi is a complete misnomer, because it's not decentralized whatsoever. There's nothing decentralized about a loan, right?
Especially if it's coming through an altcoin, right?
it's got like seven layers of centralization, so it doesn't make any sense that they could call themselves decentralized. And it's not really finance. Finance is putting capital towards a productive asset. There's no productive asset here. It's all Ethereum or governance tokens or whatever. It's all like a house built on sand, right? Like it's an entire house of cards. There's a really good article by Alan Farrington and Big Al that you can go look up, Only the Strong Survive, which talks about exactly this. You can see that the entire thing is built on nothing. Whereas like, you know, in the current financial system, at the very least, like there's ultimately some financially productive asset, like an oil well or, you know, actual pork belly, right? Like that gets consumed or something like that. That makes sense because those are financial assets. They're capital goods that are productive. The stuff in DeFi is like not finance. It's neither decentralized, it's not finance. So go read the article if you're curious, but that's what I would say about that.
So another thing that struck me recently is, you know, we've got this problem where we talk about the climate, we talk about resource allocation, we talk about our increasing population, all being these problems. And I almost it made me wonder if the problem is are the increasing population, or if it's just the economic ideology that requires us to continue consumption at crazy rates in the name of profit. Like, it feels like if we could re-sort of think the way we do things and our priorities and you know, and free ourselves from this centralized control, that we could, you know, essentially the earth could maybe support as a large, large population, much larger than we have. We just have to simply stop spending at the rates we are and consuming at the rates we are for things we don't need, to produce things we don't need necessarily. But I also wonder, because something else about Bitcoin that struck me, and I hope I understand this properly, is that it's as divisible as we would want it to be. So even though the value would always be pegged to whatever Bitcoin is worth at that time, that individual Bitcoin could, for an increasing population, be divided as many times as need be to suffice for all the transactions that need to occur in the world. But would that not still then allow us to consume at runaway rates?
Yeah, well, so the thing that you're talking about is Malthusianism, and it's by this guy Malthus, who thought that the Earth can't possibly support like a billion people or something like that. And of course, we have like we have way more than that. And that's sort of like the ideology of a lot of people that are on the radical left that tend to be like, hey, you know what, like the earth can't support these people. We need to, not have as many children and all this other stuff. I think that's all bunk, and they lack imagination in terms of, you know, what humans are capable of when necessity calls for it. And innovation is very powerful. And you know, I think Malthus lived it in like, 1795 or something like that. And, he was like, food increases linearly and population increases exponentially. Therefore, it's not going to work. Well, it turns out that there are technologies and farming techniques and grazing techniques and all kinds of stuff to, have enough food for everybody. There are ways to farm like very efficiently now that aren't even, remotely tapped out. You can grow like 5 pounds of potatoes in like 1 cubic foot of dirt if you wanted to. Just that like every farmer doesn't do that because that requires more, specialized, equipment and things like that. There's plenty that we could do. And this idea that we're going to run out of stuff is more sort of like an article of faith among the among those that adhere to it. Now, as far as the other thing that you mentioned, which is about the divisibility of Bitcoin on chain, it's divisible down to 8 decimal places. So 100 million Satoshis equals 1 Bitcoin. So currently 1 Satoshi is worth like 0.06 pennies. Right? Like that's it's you need like 18 of them to get one penny. So it divides very finely. But on Lightning, you can go down four more decimal places. So I think Adam Back mentioned that if you go down to a millisatoshi, that's about the cost of one grain of sand, which is kind of like an insanely finely divisible thing. And we could go down even further than that if need be. So, you know, the runaway consumption, runaway spending, I that is largely due to fiat money. When people have no good place to store their wealth, they tend to spend it, which is kind of what's happening right now, right? Like every restaurant is full. You try to go buy furniture, like you can't go get it from anybody. You know, it's like 4 month delivery times and stuff like that. Everything's back ordered. It's because everyone is consuming because there's no good store of value right now. And this is where Bitcoin shines. And this is where, you know, once people realize Bitcoin is a much better store of value than anything else out there, you know, a lot of this consumptive behavior kind of goes away. And you don't get sort of like very backwards things. Like one of the things that I criticize environmentalists about is a lot of what they object to end up actually creating more problems, right? Like, so, you know, Freon was like something that was used in air conditioners for a long time. And these air conditioners would last like 50 years. If you have like a 50-year-old air conditioner, you still use it because like it still blows cold air. It's like fantastic for what it does. But then like, you know, the environmentalists lobby argued for Freon being like non-biodegradable. So they substituted it with a weaker biodegradable one. Now, like you have to replace your air conditioner every 7 years. Now, that's great for air conditioning manufacturing companies, but it's not good for the environment because every 7 years, there's like a new set of air conditioners that's filling up a landfill. And a lot of what they argue for ends up being like that, right? Like dishwashers are similar, right? Like in the 60s, it used to take 45 minutes for your dishwasher to run. It just used 12 gallons of water. But because of like environmentalist concerns, now you can't use more than like 3 gallons. So of course it takes 4 hours and it doesn't clean your dishes nearly as well. And, you know, old ones get thrown away and new ones get put in. And this is what like weird regulatory, you know, political alliances essentially end up doing is justifying stupidity, which is what a lot of this is.
Yeah, you mentioned that, you know, that people were spending because there is no value to be held in the current monetary, you know, holding of money, but I also think, you know, I think it goes a little deeper than that even. I think it goes over like decades of the society of people generation after generation kind of being, for lack of a better term, brainwashed into this consumerism mindset where, you know, most people, even though they live paycheck to paycheck, they're still kind of in this routine of, I got to have this or I got to have that or I got to do this or I got to do that. And, you know, I think there's got to be some way that we're going to have to realize we kind of have to maybe break that mentality as well, because even if they had something that did hold value well, I think there's a lot of individuals in society that would have a hard time breaking those spending habits regardless.
Yeah, I don't have much to add to what you just said. It gets correct.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, we talked earlier about regulation. Like, who do you think should be making regulation on this? Because I look at the political leadership and those guys don't seem to have a clue. You know, I know if I don't understand it, I'd very seriously doubt a 75, 80-year-old man who's probably still using a flip phone it should be the one making legislation around this.
I don't know if that they should, right? Like, I think like a lot of securities laws are completely irrational as well, right? Like, And like the stock market's become way too important because there's no good store of value and stuff like that. So I would like as a libertarian, I'd like to see most regulation just be completely removed. But if there has to be regulation, then I'd rather have it be like reasonable instead of completely ignorant, kind of like what was in the infrastructure bill. So,
yeah, that was insane. What they were
putting in. There were two clauses in there that were just absolutely ridiculous. So, but that's just kind of how things are. So, yeah.
Yeah, very true. Well, I want to be cautious of your time. I know you're a busy guy. Where can people find you online? Tell them where they can find you online and get a good education on what's going on in Bitcoin.
So I am available on Twitter at Jimmy Song. I also have a newsletter, jimmysong.substack.com. And I have a podcast, Bitcoin Fixes This, which you can find on your favorite podcasting platform.
Yeah, I highly recommend that one too, because it kind of really brings this abstract concept to most people into more of a tangible real world application, which I think is really important for people to understand this. Well, thanks again for joining me today. I really appreciate it, and have a good day, sir.
Thank you.
Thanks again for joining the Evolved Idiots. If you like the content, if you like the show, please like, please subscribe, please follow us. We're available wherever you listen to podcasts. That could be literally anywhere. Spotify, Stitcher, Amazon, Google, you name it, we're there, I promise. We're also available on video on YouTube. You can just Google Evolved Idiots. You can also like and follow us on our social media, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can also watch all of our uncensored content since YouTube has become unfavorable toward open dialogue and free thought. You can see us there, all our uncensored content over on Odyssey as well, just at Evolved Idiots on Odyssey. So tune in next time. Until then, peace, love, and power to the people.